Russia pressing for control over Ukraine's southeastern Donbas region after taking full control of the port city of Mariupol. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison concedes defeat in national elections that end a decade of conservative rule. And Palestinian mourners take part in the funeral of a 17-year-old boy who was shot dead by Israeli forces earlier today. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia has just cut off flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, although regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gazprom says that it has been carefully preparing for the situation. Last Saturday, Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted their bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. As the war in Ukraine continues, the West is taking measures spearheaded by the United States that would add more fuel to the burning flames. That is particularly concerning given the devastating toll the conflict is taking on the global economy. This begs the question, are we looking at a prolonged war in Europe, and if so, what would it mean for the rest of the world?
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February.
Russia had demanded security guarantees from the West before the war began on February 24. Had the U.S. and Europe granted that, the conflict could have been totally averted. But instead, the West responded with more pressure on Kremlin, and now it has practically turned Ukraine into a battleground for a proxy war with Russia. How can the situation therefore be diffused, if at all?
As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but they're inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
As a correspondent, Johnny Miller reports from Mariupol, which is now under Russian control, Russian forces are moving out of the town and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk, Donbass region.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass, as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road. Because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
Australia's Conservative Prime Minister has conceded defeat in national elections as vote counting gets underway.
It's a difficult night for Liberals and Nationals around the country, as nights like this always are. They are humbling, but so is victory. Victory is also humbling and always should be. Tonight, I've spoken to the Leader of the Opposition and the incoming Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and I've congratulated him on his election victory this evening.
Scott Morrison says even though vote counting is incomplete, the opposition Labor Party looks likely to form a government. He added that he would stand down as the leader of the Liberal National Coalition Party. Early results show the Labour Party has 72 seats and needs 76 seats of the 151-seat House to form a government. The defeat ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in the government. Inflation and climate change were major voter concerns during this election. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades. That is higher than the current wage growth, leaving many people concerned about rising living costs. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident came days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhla while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says Israeli forces keep attacking the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, retaliation for Palestinians' anti-Israeli operations.
Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin refugee camp and the city because we have to remind our viewers that a number of Palestinians from Jenin carried out anti-Israel operations and left Israeli settlers dead and wounded in the last few months. And this, of course, had angered the Israeli military and the Israeli street as well. So in order to silence the Israeli settlers and the demands by the Israelis to change the Israeli cabinet, the Israeli forces continue to raid Jenin and its refugee camp almost on a daily basis, storming Palestinians' homes, arresting people, shooting at Palestinians and Palestinian youths.
The British Home Secretary Priti Patel has branded the anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. Comments were made during a recent speech at a pro-Israel lobby group meeting where she additionally reaffirmed her loyalty in defending Israel. Rob Carter has more.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act. These comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital, Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The reports said the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May 14th, killing 5 Syrian soldiers. On Damascus, a correspondent, Mohammed Ali, tells us more about the repeated acts of Israeli aggression against Syria.
According to an official military source, at about 11 p.m. local time in Damascus, Israel carried out a missile attack, a surface-to-surface missile attack, which was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan and hit targets in areas in the southern countryside of Damascus. Right away, Syria's air defenses, as usual, intercepted the attack, shooting down most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because three persons were killed as a result of this attack. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack, especially this year, or at least this month, in which Israel stepped up its attacks, whether in central Syria, in areas like Musyaf and Hama, or around the Syrian capital, Damascus, or in the south, around Al-Quneitra. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General with regards to such attacks, but so far, despite the tens of letters, there are still international silence about this. Still, there is no action being taken as an independent country is being attacked, a sovereign country is being attacked.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Promises of jobs and investments are doing little to convince a remote Lincolnshire community to agree to hosting the UK's nuclear waste. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Sandra Laville titled, "It's a Bribe: The Coastal Areas That Could Become the UK's Nuclear Dump." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. On the unspoilt Lincolnshire coast, where walkers enjoy the 5 miles of golden sandy beach and families take holidays in the caravan parks beyond the dunes, the efforts of British politicians to persuade the public nuclear energy is green, safe and clean do not seem to be gaining traction. A skull glowers down from the sand dunes to the Mablethorpe beach, a portent of death and destruction, and a throwback to the campaign for nuclear disarmament protests of 1980s. It is here, in a 24-hectare disused gas terminal bordering the beach, that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's big bet on nuclear energy is being tested. Experts on nuclear waste have said that until the UK builds a large underground nuclear waste dump or geological deposit facility, or GDF, to safely store the 700,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste from the country's 20th century nuclear program, to new nuclear plants should be created. It is a problem that has dogged the development of nuclear energy not only in the UK, but across Europe and in the US. How to safely and permanently store the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle. The solution of the GDF was put forward nearly 50 years ago, but the UK is no nearer to putting spades into the ground, and the cost of decommissioning and disposing of the country's radioactive waste has risen to £131 billion. When the Prime Minister recently promised 8 new nuclear plants in as many years, the problem of the highly radioactive waste they would add to the stockpile was not mentioned. However, it is something very much at the forefront of the minds of those living in the remote Lincolnshire village of Teddlethorpe and the neighbouring town of Mablethorpe. Residents learned the seaside resort could become home to a vast nuclear dump, not from officials, but when a local BBC News programme broke the story revealing talks had been taken place for 2 years. According to documents from Radioactive Waste Management, now part of the Nuclear Waste Services, NWS, the gas terminal site is under consideration for the onshore facility, and the dump would be docked 6 miles off Mablethorpe Beach, between 200 and 1,000 meters below the sea. It would be made up of subterranean tunnels and vaults with natural and artificial barriers to minimize the escape of radioactivity. Inside, the waste from the past 50 years of nuclear programs, most of which is temporarily stored at Sellafield at Cumbria, would be deposited and sealed off forever. The dam would also have room for another 73,000 cubic metric of waste from a new nuclear program of up to 16 GW. The revelations sparked a grassroots protest, which appears to have spread quickly among the retired population, many of whom moved to the area for its coastal beauty. Anti-nuclear signs dominate country lanes, skeletons have been erected on the beach and outside homes, and a series of public meetings have been held over the past 8 months by a group called Guardians of the East Coast. Sarah Bright, who lives in Mablethorpe, says, "I was totally shocked when we found out," adding, "this area was just not elsewhere we ever thought they would put a nuclear dump. This is a tourist area. We have this beautiful beach. There is investment in tourism here. We rely on that tourism income, and the idea that they could consider putting a nuclear dump here is just shocking to me." It is responses such as these that have repeatedly seen off attempts to build an underground dump for nuclear waste in the UK. One 9 years ago in Cumbria was rejected after an impassioned campaign by environmentalists and local people. However, NWS says this time the approach has been different. The government agency privately acknowledges that attempts in the past to find a site for dump have been shrouded in secrecy. Any location for GDF has to be based on science, the geology of the area, and the technical requirements of a mammoth engineering project. Crucially, though, the community that will host it must also be supportive. This time, NWS invited communities to put their area forward. 4 areas have identified themselves as willing to consider hosting the facility: Allerdale, Mid Copeland, and South Copeland in Cumbria, and Teddlethorpe. NWS promises the community that hosts the dump will benefit from great economic development opportunities, including jobs and investment in roads and railways. In Lincolnshire, a community partnership is in the process of being set up. John Collins, a former leader of Nottingham City Council and the independent chair of the working party set up in Teddlethorpe to decide on GDF, has been holding meetings to provide information and answer questions from local people for several months. He says, "If this was just a process of someone trying to sell an idea to the community, I would not have been interested in taking part, claiming what I think is really interesting in public opinion terms is that sense of this is a big infrastructure project and it has got local implications. We need to work with the community and we are asking the community to make a judgment on this at the end of the process, and if people don't want it, then it doesn't happen. John Collins claims we talk to people about safety, about why the area is being considered and what kind of timescale we are talking about, adding most people are reasonably open-minded. Some people are pretty much not in favor and some are concerned about the potential impact locally. An initial assessment has concluded that the Lincolnshire site has the potential to host a GDF. Acknowledging the natural beauty of the area, NWS promises it will contribute to protecting conservation areas around the site and incorporate flood mitigation measures. The agency has also attempted to placate those who complain the dam will kill tourism in the area. The assessment claims there may be an opportunity to create a GDF Scientific Center of Excellence, which itself could generate significant visitor traffic and even become a tourism point of interest. For the Mablethorpe councillor and Labour leader on East Lindsay District Council, Tony Howard, NWS's promises on behalf of government are nothing more than a bribe. He said, suddenly they want us to have a nuclear dam and they are promising us railways, roads, local jobs. It's just 30 pieces of silver, a bribe. The idea that everyone is going to go from selling burgers in the summer to becoming nuclear experts and working on this site is ridiculous. There will be specialists brought in to do this work. He questions the very idea that nuclear energy is green, clean and safe at all. He said, we know very well in this area the dangers of nuclear. Every year we host children from Chernobyl who come to the seaside for a holiday. We are fully aware that if things go wrong at a site like this, they stay wrong permanently, and that does not sit well with trying to promote the town as a place with a super beach, which is wonderful for families. It jars, adding, we should be investing in solar, wind, desalination. This site would be perfect for that. Nuclear is a folly. Ken Smith of Guardians of East Coast is worried that the process of reaching a decision could take up to 15 years. He said, in that time, tourist investment will drain away. Why would you want to invest in a caravan park if you think a nuclear dump is going to be built next to it? This whole process should stop right now. As the tourist season in Mablethorpe begins, NWS appears to be spreading its bets, seeking other areas to come forward. Its Director for Community Engagement and Sitting Simon Hugh says, the UK search for a suitable site is about engaging in dialogue with communities and building an understanding of what hosting a GDF might mean for them, so that we can all make an informed decision. He asserted the previous process was very rigid and demanded decisions were made at set points and before all the information was available, claiming the new process allows communities to engage in a much more flexible way, allowing questions to be answered without commitment. Communities also have the option to withdraw from the process at any time and will have to give explicit consent before construction can commence. If the local community doesn't want it, it won't happen. Simon Hugh claimed, with over 60 years of legacy waste currently stored temporarily in surface sites around the country, developing a GDF is about delivering a safe, secure, and environmentally sound long-term solution that protects current and future generations, ensuring it works for the host community and the country as a whole.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
One of the things that is important in trying to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we need to know, of course, it's difficult and it's going to take time, but we do need to work on it. What is that? الرضا بقضاء الله. نَبْلُوكُمْ بِالشَّرِّ وَالْخَيْرِ فِتْنَةً. Not good and evil in that sense, but rather what is favorable and what is unfavorable, what is desirable and what is undesirable in this material realm. Both will be brought to you. And إِنَّ مَعَ الْعُسْرِ يُسْرًا. You have hardship, there's difficult, there's undesirable, unfavorable things, and then there's favorable things, the things that are we desire, we like. In this realm, there's both. And the hereafter, for the believers, there's only khair. There's only favorable, desirable, enjoyable things waiting for them. And for the kuffar and the enemies of God, there's only shar awaiting them. Things that happen can be categorized in one of those two. In terms of us liking or disliking, it's either shar or khair. It's either usr or it's yusr. In terms of taklif, it's a whole different thing. We need to develop in ourselves ar-ridha biqada'illah, whether it's the shar or the khair that comes our way, the desirable and the undesirable, whichever it is that comes our way, we need to see it to be from Allah, and we need to be pleased with it. الرضا بقضاء الله. Being pleased with it. This is very tough to do, especially in the context of taklif. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this so that we can conceptually differentiate between the two. So practically, while we have arrida biqada illah, we can still have anger towards one of God's creation, which is our taklif. Amir al-Mu'minin salawatullah wa salamuhu alayhi, qasim al-jannati wa nar, the scale of iman that everyone was going to be measured compared to him, and the more similar you are, the higher level of iman you have, and the more different you are, the lower you are. Amir al-Mu'mineen got angry. But angry at what? Angry at whom? Angry at Allah? For why this is happening? No. Ridha biqada'illah. While he had ar-ridha biqada'illah, he's completely pleased with what's happening. He has a taklif in the context of people not listening to his command, not because it's his command, but because God has said to command them when they disobey. That is the context of you being angry with them and speaking to them with that anger and saying, Ya ashbah al-rijal wa la rijal. Those who resemble men but aren't men. Amir al-Mu'mineen did not look happy at all, and he wasn't. He wasn't happy with the people that he was addressing. He wished, لَوَدِدْتُ. He wished and said, I would have loved never to have seen you or known you. That shows that he's very unhappy, and he's not making words up, empty words that he doesn't have. He feels that way internally. But towards whom? Towards Allah? No, towards them. That's his taklif. He's supposed to feel angry. He's supposed to feel upset. And he's supposed to speak with anger. There are times when you get angry, the taklif is actually, it's okay to feel anger, in a sense. Somebody disrespected you, okay, the feeling came, all right, well, that's the feeling came. How are you going to respond? Should I speak with anger? If it was someone that didn't realize what they're doing, or they did realize, but in the sense of, yeah, they slapped me or they disrespected me and they knew they were disrespecting me, but they're an ignorant person. They didn't realize what a bad thing they're doing. Or whatever other context that God has said, be patient with them. Well, in that context, the feeling comes, act patiently with them. Overlook their misdeed. Don't speak to them in that way. But there are certain times that God says, no, show your anger. Be angry, remain angry. Show it in your speech, in your behavior, in a certain way, meaning you're not allowed to just do whatever in that context because you're angry. No, even in that case, Amir al-Mu'minin could have, he single-handedly took out the gate of Khaybar. Single-handedly, the people that he was addressing and saying, you're disobeying me, if they would have seen a few of them lifted the way that gate of Khaybar was altogether, wrapped in a bundle, and you lift them and throw them, and they land God knows where, well, that'll be enough. Everybody's going to be all ears and listening to Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ali ibn Abi Talib doesn't want to listen, doesn't want them to listen to him because they're afraid of him. He's not like Muawiyah. So God says, no, I don't, that's not how you're going to show your anger. Show it by expressing that you're angry at what you're doing, what they're doing. In speech, speak to them in that way. Talk to them and try to convince them what they're doing is very wrong with that speech, with that display of anger. If they listen, they listen. They don't listen, your taklif is done. While he's angry at them, not at Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At every point, whatever happens, and the focus right now, because this is where to be pleased with what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about, the more difficult part is what's undesirable. What's desirable, it's easy to say, alhamdulillah, you know, it's I'm pleased with what God has given me. But when it's difficult, so now that the confusion, like to think that a person who is pleased with what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings their way does not look angry at a time where something happens, or at any time, to think that, oh, you're never going to be angry. Why? Because I'm pleased with whatever happens. That's a misunderstanding of this. You're never angry with God. You're never angry with God. With His creation, sometimes God says, I want you to be. The verses of the Quran is that God's wrath includes certain people. For those people, part of God's wrath is a believer's wrath towards them, the way God says it, and whatever way He says it needs to be expressed. So to say that, no, I'm not going to be angry at all because رِضَى بِقَضَاءِ اللَّهِ, that is incorrect. It may be a taklif to feel angry and to show anger towards a person, a creation, a people. It may be not a taklif, but okay to feel angry at a creation for it not functioning or whatever. And that's something that needs to be looked into, whatever God says. If God says, no, I don't want you to be angry at an object that doesn't function, okay, I can't be angry at that. I'm supposed to change that, my behavior at least. If He says, it's okay if you feel angry, but cap it and don't express it, okay, I'm not going to express it there. If He says it's okay to be angry and it's okay to express it, you get angry, throw that thing against the wall, it's okay. If He says it's okay, then all right, it's okay. It's not taklif, but if you feel like doing it, you said it's okay, okay, I'll do it. So I'm angry, but angry at what? At whom? At Allah or this object?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar, Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Michael German, a former FBI special agent who infiltrated white supremacist groups in the 1990s, says the FBI continues to underplay the scope of the threat. We're prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled, Former Special Agent Warns FBI Failing to Address White Supremacist Violence. Leading authority on law enforcement has told The Guardian that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is failing to address the rising scourge of white supremacist violence. Despite stark warnings that such attacks pose the greatest domestic terrorism threat in the United States. Michael German, a former FBI special agent who infiltrated white supremacist groups in the 1990s, said the Bureau continues to underplay the scope of the threat. As a result, communities targeted by white supremacists and far-right militia groups, such as the largely African-American neighborhoods in Buffalo, New York, where 10 people were killed by a racist gunman recently, are left fatally exposed. Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center at New York University School of Law, says U.S. law enforcement is failing, as it long has, to provide victimized communities like Buffalo's with equal protection under the law. They're not actually investigating the crimes that occur. Recent mass shooting incidents in Buffalo was carried out by a white gunman who selected the top supermarket because it served one of the largest black populations in the state. In a 180-page diatribe he is believed to have posted online, he espoused the false racist belief that white Americans are being replaced by immigrants of color. Numerous recent studies have pinpointed white supremacy as the greatest domestic terrorism threat in America today. The FBI itself has sounded the alarm bells, with its former director Christopher Wray telling Congress in 2020 that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists were the main source of ideological killings, superseding Takfiri terrorists. In an interview with The Guardian, Michael German said that U.S. law enforcement in general and the FBI in particular were lagging behind. Despite a clear mandate from Congress, the Bureau has yet to produce statistics revealing the scale of white supremacist crimes, adding, "White supremacists kill far more Americans than anybody else, the FBI designates as domestic terrorists, yet the Bureau still doesn't document the crimes and fatalities that occur. Michael German added, "I think that's a reflection of lack of concern for the victims of that violence." U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland put out a statement after the Buffalo mass shooting in which he pledged to seek justice for the innocent victims. He said, "The Justice Department would treat the massacre as a hate crime and an act of racially motivated violent extremism." In Michael German's opinion, both these designations, hate crime and racially motivated violent extremism, are problematic in terms of how they are routinely applied to white supremacist incidents. Most acts that are deemed to be hate crimes are deferred by the Department of Justice to state and local police for investigation, though 85% of those agencies do not recognize hate crimes as a phenomenon. Michael German said, "Police in these jurisdictions don't record or may not even investigate hate crimes, so the incident gets lost. The invisibility of white supremacist hatred to law enforcement is reflected in those official figures that do exist. In recent years, surveys based on the experiences of crime victims themselves have recorded more than 200,000 hate crime incidents each year. Now compare that with the average number of hate crime cases prosecuted by the Department of Justice annually. 21, Michael German said. Racially motivated violent extremism is also less than helpful as a designation, though it is classed as terrorism. It is a catch-all in which white supremacy groups are lumped together with black nationalists and those classified as black identity extremists. The end result is that the spotlight that should tightly focus on the growing threat of white supremacy is diffused. Federal resources are scattered between animal rights groups, Native American protesters, and even non-violent civil disobedience movements designated as terrorist entities, though there is no evidence that such groups exist. Meanwhile, organized criminal groups dedicated to upholding white power fly largely beneath the radar. Michael German said there is a dramatic contrast with the overweening surveillance that was aimed at Muslim communities after the 9/11 events. He pointed to the many telltale signs that the Buffalo suspect appears to have offered months before Saturday's 14th of May's attack. He announced a murder-suicide mission at his school that was referred to state police. According to the Washington Post, the matter was dropped after the individual reassured them he had been joking. Michael German said, "Can you imagine if the Buffalo shooter had been a Muslim?" And he was telling his friends that he was enamored with Osama bin Laden, adding, "You have to think the response would have been very different." Michael German said it was puzzling that an institution like the FBI, that had effectively turned itself into a counterterrorism intelligence agency after 9/11, was, by contrast, so lax in its handling of white supremacy. He said one factor was that the FBI displays the prejudices of American society writ large, adding, "We fail to recognize how foundational white supremacism is to our culture." FBI agents are also overwhelmingly white and male, and the Bureau has been infused with elements of white supremacist ideology stretching back decades. Michael German knows that from personal experience. He said, "When I was going undercover in the 1990s, I was warned about sympathy towards white supremacy among officers. That was raised as a hazard for my undercover FBI operation." In 2006, the FBI drew up an internal intelligence assessment that found that white supremacist presence among law enforcement personnel is a concern. It said that organized groups were infiltrating law enforcement agencies, while individuals sympathetic to white supremacist causes were also joining the ranks. That was 16 years ago. To this day, there has been no national effort to root out the infection. Michael German says if there had been an internal FBI report that Takfiris had infiltrated U.S. law enforcement, you'd expect a nationwide attempt to get to the bottom of it. Given the devastating nature of the Buffalo shooting incident and President Biden's promise to the victims' families that hate will not prevail, the Department of Justice is likely to devote resources to this particular investigation. But Michael German warns that the underlying tendency to under-record and underestimate the scope of white supremacist criminal activity shows no sign of changing. What does that do to people of color who are the targets of all the hatred? It creates a recognition for these communities that they have to solve their own problems. They know that law enforcement, the FBI included, treat them harshly when they are suspects and ignore them when they are victims.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The activities in Jenin has enraged the Zionist regime to the point of madness. This is why 20 years ago, the usurping regime killed 200 people in the Jenin refugee camp in response to the death of a few Zionists in Naharia, with the purpose of forever concluding the Jenin matter. Polls show that almost 70% of the Palestinians in the 1948 and 1967 lands and in the surrounding camps encouraged the Palestinian leaders to carry out attacks on the Zionist regime. This is an important phenomenon because it signifies the complete preparedness of the Palestinians to confront the usurping regime, and it provides the Mujahid organizations with the freedom to take military action whenever they deem necessary.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The jihadi moves of the people of Palestine in the two northern and southern parts of the 1948 lands, and at the same time, the massive rallies in Jordan and Eastern Quds, the brave defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Palestinian youth, and the military maneuvers in Gaza indicate that all of Palestine has turned into an arena of resistance. At the present time, the people of Palestine are unanimous about continuing this struggle on the path of God. These incidents and what has occurred in Palestine in recent years is a seal of annulment on all schemes for compromise with the Zionist enemy. This is because no scheme or plan about Palestine is implementable in the absence of Palestine or against the consent of its owners, the Palestinians. This means that all former agreements such as the Oslo Accord, the Arabian two-state solution, the deal of the century, and the recent humiliating attempts for the normalization of relations have been nullified.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.